Blog Talk Radio.
I'd like to welcome each and every one of you to the Care to Read Room. as we feature National Poetry Month and Teacher Appreciation Day. Why don't you join us in celebration of our literary poets, narrative, and authors. In a feature story. This evening we will be reading the story of Maya Angelou, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. Join me as I feature the narrative, Never My Voice, and a special feature story by Rex Ellis, Beneath the Blazing Sun, They Told Me. I'll be reading a short segment from that book. Want to miss this feature story? So join us and gather around, children. You may be seated. Take your proper places. This is National Poetry Month, and on account of a Teacher Appreciation Day, we'd like to call all the teachers in the room to acknowledge them as well and encourage them to help to close the gap of disparity of illiteracy. That's right. We're urging every teacher to be a part of engaging their students. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you once again. And our long introduction, and that solo introduction, is the theme song from Color Purple, Alice Walker. That's right. You recognize, good for you. Now, let me get on with the show. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to be featuring a story by Maya Angelou, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. I'm going to be pointing out specific objectives to understand how autobiographies can shed light on experiences of people, their lifestyles, and specific places that they've lived. And we're going to try to grasp the importance of settings and the narrative work. And we're going to also recognize the similes and metaphors as we look for figurative languages and gain the practice identifying these elements. That's good practice for you students. Now, teachers, I hope you're gathered around the terminal, and I hope you've encouraged your children and your student. Now, we're not going to write in our journals today, but I encourage you to write a paragraph in your journal every day. Now, when you go back and write, you might want to write about your neighborhood experiences. And we're going to be featuring Maya Angelou's story, as I told you. And I want to look at some of the selection that come from African-American literature. That's right. And this is the teacher's manual, of course. This is the same book I used when I was teaching in sixth grade. So this is at a sixth grade level, which is inducive for everyone who is of age to read. Now, those elementary students, it might be a little difficult for you. And I urge you to go out and get the videotape or the book on I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings and go over these details. Now, Maya Angelou once wrote that growing up in the South was so painful for her, that she spent most of her years traveling around the world and working on various creative projects just to prevent from going home in order to put those early years behind her. They were so drooling, she couldn't stand it. She went to London to write the story, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. That's right, she went abroad. She went to London because she dreaded the South. She had dreadful days in the Southern South. This young youth decided to put her memory behind her, realizing that this would have to, she'd have to face her fears one day or another, but she wanted to put it behind her while she was in London. And she had serious flashbacks of her past. And she tried to make sure that she kept her life pleasant. The selection in this text that I'd like to talk to you about is her autobiography, okay? Maya Angelou began to write this book, which is an autobiography of herself, and she pointed out certain biographical things that she wanted you to know about while she was writing this document, while showing the feelings and the insights of a particular person. She wanted you to know about herself. As Maya Angelou suggested in her introduction, she wanted to talk to people about what happened to her in those days when things were good. Many African women have shared their experiences just like Maya Angelou, and so have I. Omi is in the process of writing an autobiography also, and I have been for the last 5 years. It takes a while, ladies and gentlemen, but at the same time, we can see the uniqueness of Angelou's life in her story. Her unusual mind and imagination just shows right up front, and she sustains her thoughts through difficult childhood and leads us into the story and into the setting, down to the story, compelling us to come and listen, that others are continually asking about her rich and vivid life. Now, we're going to ask some questions here, but I want to get into the meta first, and I want you to know that I'm going to motivate you to go out and get this book, and that's what this is all about, to give you an intriguing desire to go and get this book and read it for yourself. All this was happening now, mind you, during the Depression years in 1929. Some of you probably can't remember if you're high school students, but for those mothers out there, you can remember the history of 1929, the latest of the Depression, and it lasted and went through until 1930s. The farmers were particularly hard hit by this Depression. That's right. There was no system of unemployment available. You couldn't go sign up for unemployment insurance or welfare assistance. It didn't exist. And in the 1933, about a quarter of America workforce were without jobs. Unemployment was highest among the minority, just like it is now. Did you not know that we were facing a depression? It's just not talked about around here, but that's what we're headed for. And in this particular story, I want you to try to vividly remind yourself there wasn't a safety net, a support system to help these people. And I want you to understand that you have it better now because you can draw from those systems. However, they're short-term. They're not long-term lived. When you get caught up in the system of welfare and unemployment, it could be a catch because no one can tell you if you can renew or appeal your extensions. And these people had no extensions or appeals. So now we must fight for ourselves and build our own economic status so that we don't get caught up in the grips of unemployment and welfare. Take a note from me. It's better when you work for your own money rather than waiting for a check to come in the mail. I know it's hard. I know sometimes we don't have a choice. But you do have a choice to make transitions and to change. Just like these people did, they began to become migrants, and they started migrating all over the country to find work, and they began to travel, moving in with their family members, changing neighborhoods, and some of them even went abroad. That's right. When Omi didn't find a job here in the United States, I went abroad to satisfy the opportunity to answer the call from Uncle Sam. Some of you may have to do that. Some of you may have to go abroad. And if you do, will you be ready? The question is, research the country. Find out where you want to go. There is an opportunity for dual citizenship, and you ought to exercise that. What am I telling you? I'm telling you, if a system decides to collapse and you have an overburden of economic strategies and problems and you see the depression right at your back door, find a solution to travel, explore other places and abroad, because in the recession, this is what our African people did. Now, how about those similes and metaphors that I told you about? When you get into your story, you'll find that on page 42, once you get the book, you'll see the first quotation used as a metaphor. It identifies the store with the fun house as an amusement park. That's one of the similes. The second assembly quote used in the metaphor and comparing the children to explorers and the white part of town to a jungle filled with predatory animals. In the third quote, you will find a simile is used to compare the eggs as the edge of the plate to children left out in the cold. The fourth quotation, and I quote, uses metaphors in comparing the cat head to a flat woman spreading out in an easy chair. That's right. Kind of funny, isn't it? The fifth quotation uses a simile. It compares movement to wiggling of a fish. In the sixth quotation, you'll find a simile is used to compare the reverence phrase to baseball. Finally, the quotation used a simile and compare the depths of the voice to rolls of thunder. These are similes and metaphors, ladies and gentlemen. I want you to say it with me, a simile and metaphors. These are things you look for in comparison and contrasting. These are some big words for some of you elementary students, but nevertheless, you might as well hear about them from Omi. Now, there are others, too, like hung loose, like stockings on a washing line. And I quote, like a game of blind man bluff. And I quote, scream like falling trees. Finally, I quote, spiked out like kindling wood. These are some things you want to look for that will help you understand what are they comparing and what are they contrasting. Now, ladies and gentlemen, and young people, I want you to understand that reading is not just calling words. You must understand what you're looking for. You must have an objective. It could be for fun, or it could be for studies, or it could be to find resource and information. Whatever you choose to create an environment for reading and literacy, remember that you must have critical thinking going on. Now, what is critical thinking? Before you do anything, I want you to remember Maya Angelou's allusion to Dunbar's poem. Ask them to read, and I'm going to ask you to read the Dunbar's poem and find out what Maya had a problem with. Why does the poet identify with the cage bird? What does the cage bird have to do with anything? You find out and come back and tell me about it. And what kind of imprisonment does the speaker have in mind? These are all critical thinking skills for you, ladies and gentlemen, and young people and boys and girls, because I know you're sitting around listening. And if you're not, maybe your mother will include you. Maybe she'll take you to the library and you can get the videotape, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Maya Angelou. I hope you've enjoyed the objectives that I brought out, and it will intrigue you to go out and get the book and the videotape. It's on VHS. And watch it. Now, let me take a short station identification, and we'll be right back at you in the air before this bus decides to move out.
I'm keeping my eyes on for you, I'm something. I hope you think that you're something too.
So take your shimmy, sister, 'cause honey, this sug is feeling fine.
That's right. The Omi is feeling fine. One of my favorite songs. Ladies and gentlemen, let's go on into a bit of the core of the story, identifying some facts. When you start to read, you must look for facts. And in this story, I Know Why the Cagebird Sings, try to look at what conditions made it necessary so that the black children had to travel along across the United States. What caused them to have to travel so much with little bitty notes pinned to their clothing? I know, because I was one of those little kids traveling across the railroad and had my note attached with me and my brother holding my arm. We traveled all over the Mississippi train station, getting back and forth to the Mideast and out to Pennsylvania. We were always on the train. Now, you think about it. Economic conditions will cause you to have to travel. That's number one, because we were going to see our daddy, and we needed to get money from him. Now, what is your excuse? Some of you have had to travel, too. Now, in this story, there was a time when Maya and her brother had to travel all the time back and forth to her mother's house. Now, what did most of the people in her hometown, which was called Stamps, what did the Stamps do for a living? What were they doing, and what was their business? And now, this is what her grandmother's last name was, excuse me. So what did they do? What did the Stamps do? Did they work the cotton field? Did they own anything? I want you to find that out. And what was Maya's mother's business before she opened the store? I gave you the answer. They were store owners. And before she opened the store, you need to find out what her business was. What did she sell? What did she buy? What was her profession? Now, how did Maya make an adventure out of working at the store? She was proud to be a store owner and her family member owning the store. What did she do? What kind of games did she play to make an adventure out of it? I'll give you a clue. She made games out of the weighing of the flour accurately. So she became very good at math and punishing herself when she didn't get it right. Okay? When she made an error in judgment, she did this. How did the men and the women of Stamps help each other in order to prepare for the winter? Now, this is something we are missing in our community. We have no community to help each other prepare for the winter. What did Maya and her family do? I'll tell you. They canned food that could be put on the shelves. They preserved the pastries and the fruit, and they put them on the shelf. And they slaughtered hog, and they divided up the meat and spread it out among the community so that everybody had meat through the winter. Sort of like what we did in our household. We had farms. We went out and we picked our vegetables, and what vegetables we brought in from the harvest, we shared them with the community. You should do that. Why don't you develop an organic garden and see how it felt to be back in those days? Now, I want you to use some critical thinking skills when you're reading this. What is the mood of the store in the morning? What kind of mood was going on in the store? Was it a pleasant one? Was it a hopeful one? How does it change in the evening compared to in the morning? You're going to do some contrasting and comparison, looking at metaphors and similes. Now, what does the passage reveal about black Southern life at this time? I'm going to have to help you with that. Life was harsh and difficult, and it was a struggle. Maya wanted to put her childhood life behind her. That's why she fled off to London to find some more pleasant times. She didn't want to mention her past. Our past is very important, ladies and gentlemen. You must remember your past in order to know what your future is, good or bad. I had a grand childhood. I loved being a part of a family that was huge and always working together in a social setting. How does Angelo react to the stereotypes that are imposed upon her? the images of the cotton picker, cotton picking truth. Come on, somebody tell me the cotton picking truth. She becomes angry and defensive because she was dignified and she knew words and she could read and she could do mathematics, so she didn't want anybody looking down on her. She did not like it. And what does her reaction reveal about the attitude toward the workers? How does she feel? You find out. Look for those clues. Maya Angelou clearly admired and loved her grandmother. Why did she love her grandmother so? What was it that her grandmother did that made her feel her grandmother was the grandest person? I'll tell you. She had a magnificent and marvelous ability to be in two places at one time. This is what Maya says. And it went from one successful business venture to another. Rose very early in the morning and began working immediately. She was a hard worker, sort of like Omi. I'm a hard worker, and I always get accused of being a workaholic, never know when to turn the candle out when I'm burning it on both ends. It's nothing wrong with that, ladies and gentlemen. Why don't you be a hard worker, too? Boys and girls, start early in the morning, and if you have to finish late to finish everything, so what? You might have to burn the candle on both ends. How do we know that she was concerned about the conduct and well-being of her children? How did the grandmother realize that Maya was developing bad attitudes and she needed to talk to her? She made sure that at least twice a year they had fresh meat, and she taught them to have good manners. Her grandmother was strict on those manners. Maya learned to be a dignified lady because of it. She was strict on it. And she taught them to behave well in church. And if they didn't, they had something coming. That's all I need to tell you. And it's okay to be brought up in a strict household because it teaches you morals. It teaches you how to set a standard. When the flood comes in, which is going to come, you'll be able to lift up a standard. Why don't you lift up a standard against the flood today? Throughout the autobiography, boys and girls and ladies and gentlemen, Maya Angelou talks about Bailey. Do you know who Bailey is? Does anyone out there know who Bailey is in the story? Raise both hands. Well, Bailey is her lovable, adorable brother, who I haven't mentioned until now. But Maya talks so vividly about Bailey because she loved him so dearly. If you have a brother or sister that you love, tell them, show them, make sure they know that you're their best buddy. How does she feel about her brother? One would ask. You're asking me? Well, she says she loves chocolate drops more than anything in the world except Bailey. That means Bailey's up there with the chocolate drops, so she must be saying that she really cares about Bailey. Many sentences start with Bailey and I. Well, Bailey said, well, Bailey did. She seems quite fond of Bailey. That's what I think. Why don't you give your opinion and find out? Read the book. View the video and come back and talk to Omi about it. Thank you so much. Now, the final story I have for you is They Told Me. They told her she'd be all right. She and her baby. They told her she would not be harmed. The one thing that kept her going was that baby. They had seen one full season before the Wikes came to Emmeline and stole them away. In the beginning of the day, the milk was strong with her. But then after many days and nights of rancid food and meager rations, the milk dried up in her breast. When the crew put them up on the deck each day, and she saw the brilliant sunlight, she realized how much she wanted life for her baby. Each day, one of the enslaved African warriors, the quiet ones, made the others give away so she and the baby could have room to feel the breeze off the ocean and tingling on the sun on their faces. She admired the sun. It respected no one, loved no one, and feared no one. It did not care about a slave ship and a mother with milk, with no milk for her only child. It was good and evil bound together in a ball of fire so bright that she could only briefly stare into its face. The warrior held his tongue, but his eyes the vast plain of the Sahara, deep, flat, and lifeless at times, and then at the other time, burning with the fire and burning with indignation. The spirit was strong with this one. Even the devil left him alone. The crew members checked the warrior chain each day because they did not want him to get loose. He silently stood there, seeming to bother other people, especially the one who guarded him. It was as if his very silent hide was hiding something important, secret they longed to know. The only time the warrior came to life was when the crew brought the mother and her child on deck. This was the only time. He knew of their love of the son, and he looked forward to their coming each day. Together they shared its powerful silence. Their ebony skin seemed to come alive under the sweltering blaze. One day, she saw the eyes look downward to stare at the water. It was a long, lonely stare, as if he longed to be with the sea. She understood that look. She had seen it in many times and many places since they left home. She had even seen some of the other Africans struggling to reach the ocean, but they were always beaten back. Only when they sat on their haunches and willed themselves to death did they finally get their wish to unite with the ocean mother. But the woman could not think of much things. She had to be strong for her child. It was the child who kept the warrior alive. It was the child. It certainly was the child. The mother was convinced of it. It had to be. And in turn, it was the warrior who kept them alive. When she saw them each day, when he saw them each day, he would hold his arms out, and the baby would go to him as if he were the father. As they stood there, as she laid in his arms, she cooed like a dove. She laid perfectly still, as if all pain had suffering had ceased, and all the emptiness had somehow been filtered. She seemed to be more alive and energetic when he saw her. Even though he did not speak, there was much said between them, the baby and him. His smile was a paragraph, his stare a speech, his genitals touched greatly a shield that could not be penetrated by the most powerful gun their white captain had. He'd hold her in his arms, look toward the sun, and hum a strange and haunting tune, something like, all was well on these occasions, if only for a while, if not any. The others would have done anything for him. They would have fought their captor if he had just taken the lead and asked. But he was far away in his head. He was in there somewhere, and the only thing that brought him out was the baby named Menelant. Sometimes he looked at her and then stared off into the water. It was as if he was scratching for the place for which he had come. But there was water all around, nowhere to go. Perhaps the mother thought he left a little Menelik back there. Perhaps holding the baby gave him comfort beyond her understanding. There were times when he first saw Menelik, he'd look as if he were going to break out into a big laugh. But something stopped him each time, and he just looked down in the water. Even with all the death and dying around, the mother wanting Menelik to live. Then, that fateful day, and her life changed forever. Menelik was so fretful and unhappy that day, and she had begun to cry. First a whimper, like a bird, chirp, chirp. Then a louder, like the bark of a squirrel. Ooh. The other woman tried to help the mother, calming the baby. They hummed with her. Rocking her with all the energy. Rocked her, but they could not comfort her. Then one of the devils came over and said, "Shut that thing up, or I'll throw her overboard." The mother pleaded with him to leave them be. She prayed that the calming spirit would come and soothe the child. She walked and rocked the child, but Menelik would not stop crying. The mother offered her dry breath, but the baby turned away and asked for food, but they refused her. All at once, the baby let out a yip, another yip. Ah! Then it was happening. The devil returned and grabbed the baby from the mother's arms. Before she could think what to do next, the warrior came from nowhere and grabbed the devil by the arm. He was in such pain from the warrior's grip that he screamed and dropped the baby with the other hand, and the warrior caught it. Menelik and her gave to the mother, just handed the baby back. A shot rang out in the warrior's groan in pain. Blood dripped down his leg. But even so, he would not let the devil go. Such horror on one face and such hate on the other. No one had seen such before. Another shot rang out, but the warrior had turned the devil in the path of the shot, and the bullet hit the captain instead. Others came to guard aid, but now the other warrior stood up and defended the opposite one and would not let them near the warrior or their fellow guard. Menelik cried out more. Every eye was on the warrior as he held the devil tightly in his grip. No one spoke. It was as if they feared that by speaking they might incite the warrior further. Then someone yelled, "Send for the captain! Send for the captain, please, quickly!" As if that was a signal, the warrior looked around at the mother. Then as Menelik, for the first time, the mother saw him smile. With blood running down his leg, gun bearing down on him, and the weight of hateful stares from all of the whites, he was smiling. Then he began to laugh. The warrior took the key that the devil had around his belt, unlocked his chain, and with the happiness of one who has just joined with the one he loves, he dragged himself to the rail and gave himself to the sea. He plunged deep into the ocean. They could see him waving and smiling as the water held him floating. Then, as if he had decided it was enough, he disappeared under the ocean with the silence they had all come to know. After that day, no one threatened them. No one mistreated them. She and Menelik received food and drink before anyone else, but it was of no use. Menelik would not eat, nor had she cried or spoke since the warrior die. The mother was worried one day as the mother and her child were brought on deck and more dead bodies were drowned overboard. Menelik began to stare at the water. She stared the same way that the warrior had stared before he took leap into the water. No! No, Menelik, no! She cried. The mother cried out and reached for Menelik. Quicker than the mother could have ever imagined, Menelik threw herself over the rail. The mother screamed, "No, Menelik, don't go!" in horror and rushed after her child, but the guards, thinking she might jump too, held her fast and held her back. She called after Menelik, "Menelik, Menelik!" in promising her she'd make all things all right again. "I will make things right, Menelik, don't go!" But she screamed to no avail. At last she saw her Menelik. The child was smiling and waving as if it was beckoning to her mother to join her. And then she saw Menelik no more. The mother screamed, "Menelik!" as if her very life force began drifting from her body and then fell limp. The guard continued to hold her fast, but now they did not need to. Her body was then useless. There was nothing left, but her spirit had died that day. She walked and she walked. She watched and she waited. But as she died that day, the only thing that had kept her from going was a promise she made to herself. She would kill them all before the ship landed. But she didn't. She continued to breathe, even in the new land called Virginia. She had many children in the new land of America, and none precious as she had called Menelik. The end. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank you for going all the way with Omi on that story. That story is a very precious one to families. Our time is up here, and we're going to say Odabo, and let's go and get on the bus because it is time for us to get on the bus and get up out of here. And I say Odabo, the bus is ready for me. Jump on board. We're on our way up out of here. Out of here. Come on, join the bus. All right, I'm going to play the dozen with you if you don't come on.